September 30th, 2001, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Lesson 41. So we left off last time with James having caught some of these ministers in a, I guess you could say, in a trap, and he... Once the sentence was pronounced, the Scottish bishops rushed home. They held a general assembly in Linlithgow on the 10th of December, 1606. And this time, the Presbyteries were informed by the king of exactly who they were to send as their representatives. Nothing like representative form of government when you when one person designates all the representatives. With a lot of pressure from the king, the General Assembly agreed to allow the bishops to be the, quote, constant moderators of the presbyteries within which they resided. But when he ratified the measure, then he added the bishops were also moderators of the provincial synods also. All but one of the synods did refuse to allow the bishops to moderate their meetings. For this, the bishops worked at forcing the presbyteries to accept their status. They were given the power to fix salaries of the ministers, and this is a, according to Hetherington, a power which they did not scruple to employ for the purpose of bribing adherents and of starving antagonists. February 1610, the archbishops of St. Andrews in Glasgow were given commissions to hold courts of high commission. And this is, again, quoting from Hetherington, "Never was a more tyrannical court instituted than that of the High Commission. It was regulated by no fixed laws or forms of justice and was armed with united terrors of civil and ecclesiastical despotism." So they could treat any case, civil or ecclesiastical, and they didn't depend on any conventional rules of justice. Let's see. A so-called General Assembly was held in Glasgow in June of 1610, again with a hand-picked assembly, filled either with the king's or the bishop's choices. A number of acts were passed. They confirmed the king's prerogative over the church in scheduling assemblies, confirmed the bishops as constant moderators, gave them powers of excommunication and absolution. All excommunications and restoration from excommunications had to be approved by the bishops. They were given responsibilities of approving, appointing, and, as necessary, deposing ministers. This was later called the Angelical Assembly because the coins used for bribing the representatives were called angels. And, let's see, the Acts of Assembly were ratified and extended by Parliament in October 1612, and at this point, James's overthrow of Presbyterian church government was essentially complete. He still had more work to do on the church to mold it, say, in his image, in the sense that in the image he desired, but he, at this point, he pretty much completely overthrown the Presbyterian form of church government. The next month, James's eldest son, Henry, Prince of Wales, died at age 18, and whether or not James built his city or his church at the cost of his firstborn son is an interesting question, but one which we won't presume to render judgment upon.
How did he die?
Typhoid? Well, thank you. Okay. I was going to say some disease, but typhoid. Okay, General Assembly then didn't meet again for nearly 4 years, so August of 1616, when it met at Aberdeen, and a new confession was drawn up, which was rather vague on the issues of church government. 1617, James came back to Scotland. He'd been gone for 14 years. He managed to get things off on the wrong foot by having an organ delivered with gilded statuettes of apostles and patriarchs. David Calderwood, a minister of the Church of Scotland, and also a well-known historian, he wrote a history of the Church of Scotland. While James was there, Calderwood was summoned by the Court of High Commission, and Calderwood declined its authority, so the king got mad, of course, and had him exiled. In 1618, August 1618, a General Assembly was held in Perth, again by the king's command. He submitted 5 articles for the assembly to ratify. When the ministers arrived, all the seats were taken by nobility, gentry, and bishops, and the Archbishop Spotswood sat down as moderator, even though he hadn't been elected. And when he was challenged, he declared that since the meeting was taking place in his diocese, it was his prerogative to moderate it. The ministers challenged the voting by the nobility, gentry, and bishops, because that most of them didn't have a commission from their presbytery to vote. They weren't elders. But Spotswood overruled them, saying they were, in effect, commissioned by the king. The king, let's see, had written a letter telling them what measures they were supposed to ratify, and there was no debate on the measures, and even though 45 ministers, one nobleman, one doctor voted against them, they still passed. And these articles required celebration of holy days, allowed private baptized, catechized children were to be presented to the bishop for him to lay hands on them. It allowed private communion, and it required that communion be received in a kneeling position. This private baptism and private communion, I guess you could say, probably flows from this sacerdotal Arminianism, this idea that the grace flows through the sacraments in sort of a mechanistic way, so we get the, you know, the bishop can then, you know, sort of hand out the sacraments, and, you know, because he's the bishop, therefore, you know, the grace flows through him, rather than sort of being a sign and seal of the covenant that you would do in public. Well, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but the church is, it's the English church is being overtaken by Arminianism, and the Five Articles of Perth moved the Scottish church into closer conformity with the English church. They were ratified by the Privy Council, and the Privy Council added the feature that people who didn't observe the act shall be repute, holden, and esteemed as seditious, factious, and unquiet persons, disturbers of the peace and quiet of the Kirk, contemners of our just and royal commandment, and shall be punished therefore in their persons and goods with all rigor and extremity to the terror of others, at the arbitrament of the lords of our Privy Council. So they made it also a crime to oppose them. Ratified by Parliament in August of 1621, and on a Saturday, there was the moment they were ratified, a terrific thunderstorm struck with lightning, very loud thunder, and large hailstones. Sometimes called Black Saturday. Okay, the Archbishop of St. Andrew Glasgow had been given these commissions to hold courts of high commission, and they were supposed to deal with church discipline, but they could really deal with anything. They did discipline ministers who spoke out against the established order of the Kirk or against any of the conclusions of the bypassed General Assemblies, right, where they, you know, the king had bribed or appointed his representatives to pass his acts. Especially the Parliament held at Edinburgh in October 1612, the Angelical Assembly. And with the ratification of the Five Articles of Perth, the Courts of High Commission now had a lever, if you will, for persecuting Presbyterians. James himself wrote a letter to the Archbishop of St. Andrews, Spotswood, to encourage them in their persecution. And he, quoting from James, he said, "The greatest matter the Puritans had to object against the church government was that your proceedings were warranted by no law, which now, by this last Parliament, is cut short, so that hereafter that rebellious, disobedient, and seditious crew must either obey or resist God, their natural king, and the law of the country. It resteth therefore to you to be encouraged and comforted by this happy occasion, and to lose no more time to procure a settled obedience to God and to us by the good endeavors of our commissioner and our other true-hearted subjects and servants. The sword is now put into your hands. Go on therefore to use it and let it rest no longer till ye have perfected the service entrusted to you." So how do they use the sword? Well, they continue James's policy of intimidating and persecuting faithful ministers. Let's see. In January 1622, they summoned four well-known and well-respected ministers, insisted they agree to the Five Articles of Perth. When they declined, three of them were banished, and the fourth was restricted to stay within the bounds of his parish. One of the ministers was Robert Bruce. This is the minister in Edinburgh who had been James's chaplain. He'd served the king as an extraordinary member of Privy Council when James had left the country to get married. And when James came back, he said he was worth a quarter of his kingdom. He was tossed in the castle of Edinburgh for seditious conduct, and he was banished to Inverness. So, which wasn't near as nice a place when they didn't have cars and hotels and everything like they do now. Okay, James apparently imagined his troubles with Puritanism in Scotland. I'll put that in quotes, but he was also dealing with English Puritans. were due solely to a few rebellious ministers. And if he could persecute them, remove them, intimidate them, he could have his way. And this was true with respect to church government. He was able to, you know, to shape things. But he couldn't so easily sway the populace on other issues. And in some congregation, there were three classes of members: those who took communion kneeling, as ordered, those who took it standing up, and those who refused to take it at all. And supposedly in Burntisland, communions in the springs of 1617, 1618 had about 900 people, whereas in 1619 there were only 450 attending. And even then, only some of those took communion kneeling. A number of Christians from larger cities went to rural churches. A number of Christians in Edinburgh turned to private conventicles, okay, private worship services. And James threatened the local magistrate that he would move the courts of session if they didn't do a better job in suppressing the conventicles. Okay, but unfortunately for James, in late winter and early spring of 1625, his health began to fail. And a day before he died, he had some kind of stroke, so that his tongue hung out and he gagged on copious quantities of phlegm. And as Otto Scott said, "Then God, a satirist who scaleth beyond all mortars, sent an attack of dysentery." He died the 27th of March, 1625, 58 years old. So, okay. Before we go on to Charles, talk a little bit more about James. Hopefully some of this is still fresh in your mind, but if you just want to summarize a little bit about his life. The class is the title A Tale of Two Kingdoms, the history of the Church from the of Scotland from the Reformation to the Glorious Revolution. The two kingdoms are the Church, which has Christ as its king, and the state, which had James as its king. The story of James's life is, in short, that he wanted to be king over both state and church. Okay, the Church resisted this, although he was more or less successful at wresting the Church's government away from the Presbyterian form of hierarchical government and creating episcopacy. The episcopacy was ruled by James himself, by means of compliant men appointed as bishops and archbishops. And this system had even less checks and balances than the pre-Reformation church, right? In the pre-Reformation church, there was a lot of abuse of power. There was a lot of intertwinement of the church hierarchy and, say, the nobles. Well, if you think about it, he's now managed really to get it all under himself, not even under the nobles. But this could lead to abuses, you know, hardly needs to be stated. James had what was probably the best possible education. He was tutored by George Buchanan. He was a child prodigy at a young age, you know, impressing visitors with knowledge of Greek, Hebrew, Latin, French, etc. Buchanan realized that James had a perverse and rebellious nature, and he even made the statement in the his dedication to his one of his plays that it was a witness to future generations that the fault lay not with his tutors, but rather with James. The play itself was about tyranny, and Buchanan apparently sensed James's proclivity towards tyranny, so he turned out to be quite prescient with regards to his pupil. And while we might debate what went wrong with James's upbringing, you know, it does serve as a warning today that the best possible education, when squandered on the young tyrant, may only end up aiding him in his tyranny. James became and remained throughout his life incredibly arrogant. He was very difficult to persuade of anything because he always thought he was right. And he always felt like he could persuade the other party with his brilliant logic. He was very proud of his so-called kingcraft, his way of ruling or maybe fleecing the people. And one example of this is this King's Confession of 1581 with the big Catholic scare. He created this confession slash covenant that was supposed to be a sort of touchstone to clearly separate true Protestants from false Protestants. A little hard to see this as being anything but a public relations ploy. He often used this sort of thing throughout the rest of his life, particularly when he was in Scotland. From time to time, make some sort of flowery speech to the General Assembly, full of statements asserting the superiority of the Church's doctrine, promising to reform himself, maintain the Church in its pure state, etc. And these promises were patently false, although it may be impossible to prove that he never meant what he said at the time that he said it. I guess it depends upon what the word, meaning of the word is. He spent 10 months of his adolescence under the control of the Lords of Enterprise, who had kidnapped him basically from Esme Stewart. And at least one of his historians believe that James honed his skills at lying under those during his captivity. Also, immediately after that, he his irritation with the church, I guess, increased when he got, at least it showed it has increased when he got free. Let's see, he banished the teacher John Dury from Edinburgh, and he had Andrew Melville hauled before the Privy Council. Right? Andrew Melville declined the Privy Council's authority, and this is an important theme, this idea of declining the authority of the civil magistrate to deal in ecclesiastical matters. Is one of the, I guess you could say, the central themes of this conflict between the church and the state. Again, as we point out, it wasn't a claim that of absolute immunity from the civil magistrate, but rather it was a claim that in all ordinary cases, the church had the right first to try any ministers for the content of their sermons. And if we have multiple controlling authorities instead of no controlling authorities, the minister is a subject of one kingdom and an ambassador of another. And in order to do that, it's necessary to have some protocol, much as we have today for dealing with the diplomatic corps from other countries. So from that time forward, there was a continual battle between the two kingdoms. It's often been called a battle for prerogative. James was trying to assert his prerogative over the church. Sometimes there were periods when the relations improved slightly, but by and large, James tried to gain more and more control over the church. It's really sort of a pattern, usually some kind of instigation on James's part, some attempt to force the ministers to swear compliance, and then persecution and intimidation of the ministers who wouldn't comply. And then sometimes some small soft was offered, a compromise that they could then soothe their consciousness with. And if that wasn't sufficient, then he could try it again. You know, just keep working on sort of an incrementalist approach. This had a number of things, but briefly, the Black Acts in 1584 proclaimed the king's authority over all estates and persons, in other words, over both kingdoms, and set up bishops of sorts. A number of ministers protested. Some were forced to flee the countries. Others were imprisoned. One was condemned to death, although he wasn't actually executed. Just had to look out on a gallows being built for him. The other ministers that protested were offered this one of these ambiguous and unmeaning clauses, which serve only to blind the simple and to salve the consciences of such as are anxious to escape from trouble. This phrase was that they would obey the bishops, etc., etc., according to the word of God. And James Melville said, as if one should say he would obey the Pope and his prelates according to the word of God. Okay, but nevertheless, a number of the ministers fell for it. There was a thawing in relations in 1592 when James was married. We had the so-called Golden Act. And then in 1596, again, the battle for prerogative heated up. James told the church there couldn't be any agreement unless they would agree to the following points, which were the minister shouldn't discuss matters of state in their sermons, General Assembly shouldn't meet without his command, nothing the General Assembly did should be valid until he had ratified it, as he ratified Acts of Parliament, and that the church should not bother itself with any offense punishable by criminal law. And if we didn't see it at the time, we certainly now in retrospect see how he was going to use these principles in a number of ways. Let's see, in December 1596 we had this little excitement in Edinburgh that he then turned this into, you know, magnified it into some kind of treasonous uprising. And with the people suitably cowed, and he, by rigging the vote by bringing in a bunch of northern ministers, he got the General Assembly to create a committee of advisors for the kings. And it sounds harmless enough, but these committee advisors in 1598 were granted a vote in Parliament, and this was approved by the General Assembly, again with a lot of arm twisting. 1600, they were granted a lifetime appointment. They actually voted for an annual appointment. The church assembly voted for an annual appointment, but the king had the clerk reword the measure. At some point, they started to be called bishops. James started appointing men to vacant bishoprics without the consent of the church. 1606, they were restored to control large estates. James started informing the church who the representatives to the General Assembly would be, and the hand-picked General Assembly approved the bishops to be constant moderators. 1609, they were given the power to set all minister salaries, and they, of course, used this to their nefarious ends. In 1610, they were given a number of other powers, at which point you could say the overthrow of the Presbyterian church government was complete. And so, I mean, James was able to accomplish quite a bit, but probably also maybe knew his limits, didn't try to go much further than that. I tried last time to summarize some lessons from James's life, which I have down as basically being a great education doesn't necessarily guarantee a great outcome, right, despite what the public school lobby might say. But this is also true of a Christian education. The best Christian education, homeschool education, whatever, if it's squandered, you could say, on an unregenerate, rebellious person, can just be used to wicked ends. As expected, a church that follows Christ truly may be expected to incur the hostility of the world. That's no surprise. Christians are naturally gullible. This is a quote from Mike. Yeah. And the characteristics often exploited in the struggle between the two kingdoms, but I hope that studying church history is an antidote for this gullibility. Internal corruption in the church is a great danger. James basically used a two-pronged approach to gain control of the church. He attacked from the outside by persecuting and exiling faithful and effective ministers, ones who could faithfully and eloquently argue for the truth. But since James wanted to control the church, if he had to exile all the faithful ministers, there wouldn't be any left. But, of course, there were ones on the inside who were corruptible and with promises of riches or coins and so on, flattering their baser instincts. In the case of the northern ministers, you know, how provoking them to envy about how the southern ministers have controlled the church and so on. He was able to get his way. And then finally, even James, in a sense, he was forced to acknowledge the Presbyterian claim. All the destructive acts originated within the church, okay, but none of them were first introduced by Parliament. Now, James introduced them into the church, but, you know, he would introduce them into general assemblies and so on. So that's one of the reasons why he needed corrupt ministers. So, okay, well, Charles began reigning in 1625. Yes? No, not in a formal ecclesiastical sense.
He was
censured like privately, you know, by Melville and others. If he was cutting too close, you know, he was at the wrong point on the power curve, as it were, he would, you know, back off. And so,
but he got a Bible in there.
Yeah. Vicki. Yeah. Well, he was also, I'm going to talk about this a little bit with respect to Charles, but he also, you know, was battling at the same time the Puritans in England, and was creating a lot of, and he viewed the Scottish struggle as an extension of that. You know, when he was writing to the Scottish Archbishop, he was referring to them as Puritans, you know, and now they've been complaining, and now we're going to get us. So Charles took over in 1625. There are sort of three different, in the first 10 years, there's sort of three different strands of history that are kind of all going on in parallel. There's Charles' interaction with the church, which we'll come to in a minute, but there were a couple other things I wanted to mention. One was the rise of Arminianism in the Church of England. Right, Arminius lived from 1560 to 1609, but the temptation of Arminianism is a lot older than that, right? It's sometimes called semi-Pelagianism. The idea being that the human heart, not being totally depraved, somehow contributes to salvation. let's see. This was from an article in the Dictionary of Scottish Church History and Theology. The N.R. Needham points out that Arminianism has taken three different forms: sacerdotal, rationalistic, and evangelical. We're primarily familiar here with the evangelical form of Arminianism. But the sacerdotal one is, quote, grace was conceived as flowing through the sacraments and the something, I left it out, and the Episcopal Church order. So, you know, again, this idea, this private baptism, private communion, is it's an outworking of that. I mean, in and of itself, it maybe doesn't sound that bad under extraordinary circumstances, but it is this idea of the sacrament being applied, having the sacrament itself being what is effective, and it's in a mechanistic sense that this, you know, the archbishop and so on can sort of make this thing flow. Yes, Mike?
When you mention that, it brings back years ago I read about John Wesley, and I didn't understand at the time, but when he would give encouragement to unbelievers, he would say, partake of the sacrament, you know, until essentially you get faith. And the idea, obviously, is that you get some benefit as an unbeliever by taking the sacrament.
Yeah, I don't know much about Wesley, but Okay, the Arminian party became prominent in the Church of England in the early 1620s. It became very influential with James towards the end of his life, and then with Charles. It culminated with William Laud, one of Charles' advisors, becoming the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1633. Laud was characterized by Hetherington, a Scottish historian, as cunning, narrow-minded, bigoted, and malevolent. He became increasingly important to Scotland also. A number of the younger, more aggressive prelates in Scotland were followers of Laud. And the Puritans in England were at odds with the Arminian party, and some of Charles' actions in Scotland were done with an eye towards this Arminian-Puritan conflict. So sometimes he did things that might not seem to even make sense from a Scottish viewpoint, but he sort of had to, because he was also fighting this, if you will, another battle on another front. Okay, the third strand of history to bring up just briefly, there were a number of revivals, real or apparently real spirit-led revivals in southwest Scotland. The effects of the revivals were long-lasting. At Stewarton in Ayrshire, the revival lasted a period of about 5 years, from 1625 to 1630, and people were converted on a regular basis. And at the Kirk of Shotts in Lanarkshire in 1630, the visiting preacher, John Livingston, gave a sermon at a communion service attended by a number of people from the surrounding area. According to contemporary accounts, many of the unregenerate were regenerated, and many of the regenerate experienced a large increase of grace and spirituality. And one, the Reverend Robert Fleming writing about this, he was born a little bit too late to have been an eyewitness, but it would have known many eyewitnesses, said, "It was known, as I can speak on sure ground, that nearly 500 had at that time a discernible change wrought on them, of whom most proved lively Christians afterward. It was the sowing of the seed through Clydesdale, so that many of the most eminent Christians of that country could date either their conversion or some remarkable confirmation of their case from that day." So, this was, in the 1620s and 1630s? Okay, and a lot of these people were then involved in the upheavals of the later 1630s. Once Charles then took over, there were several things that allowed a brief respite from the persecution. The Court of High Commission expired because it was dependent on James's personal authority. So, like some of these punishments, like banishment, were null and void. So Robert Bruce was able to return from Inverness to Edinburgh. But shortly thereafter, Charles wrote the Archbishop of St. Andrew Spotswood that he was to continue on the same course and enforce the ecclesiastical changes made under James. He issued a royal proclamation in August of 1625, which commanded obedience to the Five Articles of Perth. In September, he commanded the Town Council of Edinburgh to choose magistrates who conformed to the Five Articles of Perth. He attempted to recover the tithes. And anyways, this wasn't so popular with the nobles. Many of them now had the right to the tithes. And so Scottish Parliament, which meant June of the next year, could be little more than appoint a commission, so he wasn't immediately successful in that. 1629, he issued orders that all councillors and other officials had to attend communion at Holyrood House at least once a year in order to keep their jobs. In other places, ministers had to keep a list of communicants. Non-communicants couldn't keep a public office. In 1630, he informed Archbishop Spotswood that it was His Majesty's will that the Church of Scotland should adopt the form of worship of the Church of England completely. Spotswood convened the bishops, and when they met, they decided the measure was too dangerous, and so they postponed further action on it. Charles made a trip to Scotland in 1633, and the purposes included being crowned as King of Scotland, right? He was only been crowned as King of England. And, he wanted to raise more money and make some more impositions on the Church of Scotland. He brought William Laud with him, and Laud decorated Holyrood Chapel, again, with where the coronation was held, with an organ, tapestries, and an altar, with two clasped books and two unlit candles. So, what's it? Those HVAC systems with two clasped books and two unlit candles. That's the thing that Melville wrote his little witty poem about that got him, you know, banned, exiled. Okay, in order for Charles to raise money, he had to hold a parliament. And it became apparent that he'd learned a few lessons from his father. He put 10 Englishmen, including Laud, on the Privy Council. And he basically controlled the lords of the articles, who drafted all the legislation for Parliament to consider. Some of the Parliament was willing to reconfirm the king's royal prerogative, but he also wanted to specify what the clergy were allowed to wear, you know, robes and those sorts of things. And when the Earl of Rose insisted that the church be consulted, he was interrupted by the king and told by the king, "I have all your names here, and I will now know who are good subjects and who are bad." Right. The act was rejected, but the clerk recorded it as having passed. So, like I said, he learned a few lessons from James.
Did he get away with that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no. I mean, in the end, he got his head cut off. But for a few years, he got away with it. I don't think overall Charles had all that happy of a reign. He spent quite a bit of it either in turmoil or in civil war, and then culminating with him taking his head off. So, let's see. Oh, the king, he then shortly thereafter went ahead and issued an order as to what the clergy were to wear. And, you know, arguably this isn't the most important thing, but it did demonstrate his view that he was considered himself to be absolute head of the church. He'd taken upon himself to serve the role of Christ. Since there hadn't been any debate allowed at this at the Parliament, some of the no votes thought they should try to petition the king, and they wrote a petition, decided it was best not to send it, but one of the petitioners, a Lord Balmerino, kept his copy of it. Later, he showed it to somebody, who then showed it to somebody else, who showed it to somebody else, who finally showed it to the king. And Balmerino was seized and charged with the serious crime of being art and part of the penning and setting down of a scandalous libel. And again, you know, he followed this page out of James's book. He tried to strike a blow at his opponents by persecuting one of their leaders and trying to cow them into acquiescence. There was a trial in March of 1565, and even though Charles had a stacked jury, in the end, Balmerino was convicted by only one vote, in effect of having done nothing, of knowing about the document and not revealing its author. He was acquitted of everything else, but he was sentenced to death anyways. Let's see. Charles, well, like his father, liked to think of himself as an absolute and free monarch, right? But he had to face reality here. The charge, trial, verdict, and sentence were hugely unpopular, except with some of the bishops, and there were rumors of violence if the sentence were carried out. And so he finally relented, and he reduced the sentence to confinement within a 6-mile radius of his home. In the middle of this Balmerino affair, Charles appointed the Archbishop Spotswood as Chancellor of Scotland, the head of the government. And along the way, he managed to alienate the masses and the nobility in Scotland. with a number of different things. He was doing more or less the same thing in England. As I said, he didn't lose his head for no reason at all. But this Balmerino prosecution is still pointed to as being one of the key turning points whereby he really alienated much of the nobility in Scotland. As we looked at earlier, the nobility in Scotland was very important for anything, for any movement. And sovereign God ordains both the ends and the means. Charles, back in England, really lost track of what his limits were, and he decided to put out a book of church government. And he had four bishops write it, and then he personally reviewed it and ordered it to be printed. It included such gems as affirming that Charles was the head of the church and had absolute authority, and anyone who denied this was to be excommunicated. He reaffirmed the five articles of Perth. National synods were specified, but no meetings of presbyteries or sessions were allowed. So if you think about it in terms of just having basic church discipline, it was overthrown. A meeting in conventicles was prohibited. And pastors could not pray extemporaneously. Right? They were only allowed to pray from books. So, okay, Charles then commissioned a book of liturgy known as the Book of Common Prayer. A number of drafts were made by some of the Scottish bishops and edited by Archbishop Laud. And it was finally approved by Charles in April of 1636. He had ordered it to be as near to this of England as might be. Scottish recent historians pointed out that this was not just because of Charles's principles, but any changes to make it fit more closely to the Scottish temper would give the English Puritans ammunition in their book in their battle against the Church of England. So, this was, it's like the Clinton form of triangulation, only different. He had two parties that he was had to be worried about at one time instead of two parties he could set at odds with each other. And in December 1636, he issued a proclamation that every parish should obtain two copies of the prayer book. But the book wasn't printed for a while, so there was some delay in actually using it. And some of the bishops, though, tried it in their own churches. And Easter of 1637 was the target date for adoption. It came and went without the liturgy being used widely. The Archbishop of St. Andrews, Spotswood, and Archbishop Glasgow Lindsay were in a struggle to obtain the rights to more tithes for themselves, and they were going to go see the king to have him, sort out who could get the, more money. And they thought maybe they should have be able to report a good reception of this new liturgy, when they went down there. So they hoped to introduce it then on the 23rd of July, 1637, in Edinburgh. And two archbishops, several bishops, and members of the Privy Council were present. And the Dean of Edinburgh at St. Giles Cathedral, or Kirk, I guess then, now called St. Giles Cathedral. But when he went to start the liturgy, a woman sitting near the front was reported to have yelled, "Villain, dost thou say mass at my lug?" That's her lug is her ear, and threw her stool at the bishop, at the dean. That began a riot whereupon many objects were hurled at the dean and subsequently the bishop when he tried to take control, and they were called traitors, belly gods, and deceivers. Okay, the rioters were ejected and the service was restarted, but the loud noises from outside, breaking glasses, battering doors, and yelling were too distracting, so they stopped the service. And most of the exact facts of the incident were lost, but she's reportedly an elderly woman, servant woman named Jenny Geddes. Although many historians claim the wife of an Edinburgh merchant was actually the instigator. Hetherington, a Scottish historian, claims it was a spontaneous uprising. As the report states that despite a concerted effort, only a few servant girls were ever arrested. Some royalist Episcopalian writers claim it was a conspiracy, but there isn't any proof of this, except that some of the Presbyterians had been previously meeting, and of course it seems very likely that it was a conspiracy. But the riot provoked people in different ways. The two archbishops tried to crack down on ministers with strong Presbyterian sympathies by ordering that they must buy and use within 15 days the Book of Liturgy or be charged with rebellion. Several of these, including Alexander Henderson, submitted a petition to the Privy Council to suspend the order. The petitions were supported by letters from a number of nobles and gentry. Henderson's petition made several points, including the fact that the Book of Common Prayer had not been approved by the General Assembly and the Scots Parliament. The Privy Council, meeting on the 25th of August, 1637, waffled by determining that the order applied only to buying the book, but there wasn't any obligation to use it. The Privy Council made a report to the king, and they told him the truth about how unpopular this was. They planned again to meet on the 20th of September, 1637, to hear his response, but the prelates were exceedingly disappointed and enraged by these proceedings of council. They now saw themselves deserted by the nobility, and they never had possessed the support of the people. So they used their influence with Archbishop Laud to further influence the king to give a very sharp reply to the council. He said that the council must remain in Edinburgh until the liturgy is established. All magistrates selected for the burghs, the important towns, must conform to the new liturgy, and the bishops must read the liturgy in their own churches. You might recall that one bishop of Brecon accomplished this by arming himself with pistols and his family with pistols, whereupon they went into the church, locked the doors, and read the liturgy. So, we note again that the king could have taken a more conciliatory course. Okay, the king's resistance or response didn't really have the effect that he intended. And of course, he was out of touch. He had bad advice. But he was just stupid. God-ordained stupidity, I guess. Resistance really began to organize in a serious manner. Within 3 days, a significant number of nobles and barons, 100 ministers, representatives from 66 parishes, representative burghs, and gentry from many of the southern counties had arrived in Edinburgh. They decided to send a joint petition back to the king, as they thought he had been misinformed, which he had perhaps. But, you know, he was at the heart of the problem. The petition was received by the king, and the answer was returned on the 17th of October. Again, people rushed to Edinburgh to hear the outcomes, and with so many people in Edinburgh, they split up into nobles, lairds, burgesses, and ministers, and met separately, kind of organizing a new government. The king's letter had few surprises. He hadn't changed his mind, but he did make orders about what should be done. The Privy Council was to take no further action on the affairs of the church. In other words, no more petitions. People gathered in Edinburgh would disperse within a day, and he ordered that the Privy Council and Court of Session be moved to Linlithgow. A new supplication was drawn up the next day by the nobles, who were quite infuriated with the king, and their supplication went beyond just the Book of Common Prayer. They also rejected the Book of Canons and the bishops. It was signed by 30 nobles, 281 lairds, 48 burgesses, and 123 ministers. In mid-November, these supplicants decided to form a sort of representative convention of the nobles, lairds, burgesses, and ministers. They met on a number of occasions. In mid-December, they chose 5 lawyers to advise them on how to proceed. Specifically, they wished to proceed against the courts of High Commission and the bishops. On the 21st of December, they submitted a formal declaration of the refusal to submit to the bishops as members of the council, acting as judges of their grievances as they were parties interested in the case. So as the bishops were part of the Privy Council, they rejected their authority. They also submitted a petition formally complaining that their previous petitions had been treated poorly, had been ignored. Okay, so the king finally started to see that he needed to take this somewhat more seriously. He summoned his senior civil servant, the Earl of Traquair, to London. The Earl of Traquair's advice was to compromise, but the bishop's advice was don't compromise. So, in mid-February of 1638, he, or maybe this is 1639 now, no, I'm sorry, 1638, he replied, he didn't give any hope to the supplicants. He took responsibility for the prayer book himself, and his only offer was one of amnesty. If they would give up and go home, we'd forgive their past offenses. And then he banned all their any future meetings as being treasonous. So they supplicants were now faced with a dilemma. Either they give up, because all legal means for expressing their grievances have been denied, or they go forward. And they met, despite the king's proclamation, decided to go further, and decided to make a covenant based on the king's confession of faith. This would be the National Covenant of 1638. And since the barbarians are at the gates, we'll stop there. Okay. So, any questions? Dave.
It does seem like since James' time and where Charles is at, that the ministers must have been reasonably effective in preaching to individuals to have aroused such large-scale public support on a widespread basis against Episcopacy.
Yeah. So, right, and that's part, and related to the question, well, how could there be these 123 ministers who are now so bold? And when I think I'm planning on doing a little biography of Samuel Rutherford, who would have been one of these ministers. Basically, even though James had overthrown the church government, there were still, for instance, there were some bishops who apparently weren't all that serious about enforcing every last minute of the thing. So there were some bishops who were sympathetic, maybe, to the Presbyterians, and so they would ordain ministers who wouldn't maybe pass muster in other presbyteries or synods or whatever. So, yeah. So there were some people getting in sort of around the... they weren't getting in through the gate. They were getting in over the wall. They were the true shepherds. So, right.